I want to start with a thought, really, that you might just like to sort of mull around in your head. What does it take for God's name to be glorified? What does it take for God's name to be glorified? If we want his name honoured, if we want his reputation to be spread abroad, what will achieve that? It's an important question, because the way we answer it will have an important impact on the way we spend our energies in God's service. People who want to serve God spend time serving him in a way that will bring him glory. They may not necessarily think of it in those terms, but if it's really true service, that's where their hearts will be focused. So if we believe that God is glorified by bringing moral reform to our country, then that's where we will expend our energies. We will focus on dealing with moral issues and trying to help morality to change. If we believe that God is glorified by great art or by buildings, then we will give ourselves to those things. And many in history have believed that the glory of God can be demonstrated by art or by buildings. If we believe that God is glorified by great music or by spiritual encounters, then we will give ourselves to those things. So the question is an important one. What does it take for God's name to be glorified? This morning, I have one major point. It's a one-point sermon. But you will be pleased to know that I have three subheadings. So that makes it a 1.3-point sermon? I have no idea. But here is my main heading that I think comes out of this passage. The way that God is glorified is through his people. God is glorified through his people. And the three subheadings are this: he will protect his people from the world. He will set his people apart for the world, and he will send his people into the world. Did you get that? God is glorified through his people, and Jesus assures us that he will protect them from the world. He will set them apart for the world, and he will send them into the world. John 17 is at the end of what is intellectually, I think, called the Upper Room Discourse. In a few moments, Jesus will be arrested, he will be tried, and he will be crucified. And the final thing that he does before he is arrested, tried, and crucified, is he prays for himself, then he prays for his apostles, and finally, he prays for us. And the main focus of the prayer is God's glory. That is very clear if you read verses 1 to 5, which I guess you did last week. Verses 1 to 5, Jesus starts his prayer by saying, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that your Son may glorify you." Verse 5, "And now, Father, glorify me in your presence with the glory I had with you before the world began." So it's pretty clear, isn't it, from Jesus' opening words, that the main concern of his prayer is that God should be glorified. So, I say this with some hesitation, but I find it, at least, rather surprising that in verse 6, Jesus should go on and pray for his disciples. Is that surprising? I find that slightly surprising. That God's name should be glorified is the main focus of his prayer, and then he goes on to pray for his disciples. And we can see that he is praying specifically for them, because he says in verse 9, I pray for them, I am not praying for the world. And in verse 12, he says, whilst I was with them, I protected them and kept them safe. He's clearly talking about the 12. And we didn't go on into verse 20, but at verse 20 he says, my prayer is not for them alone. So clearly, in verses 6 to 19, he is praying specifically for the 11. He mentions Judas. He says Judas has fallen away. That was planned. So put Judas to one side. I am now praying for the 11 who have followed me. And the reason is there in verse 10. All I have is yours, and all you have is mine, and glory has come to me through them. God is glorified in his people. Jesus says, glory has come to me, and therefore to God, through the 11 that I am praying for. If you use the Authorized Version, you will find that the Authorized Version uses the phrase, it translates this, I am glorified in them. And actually, the tense is one you see very often in the New Testament. It is a past tense with continuing present implications. That sounds a bit intellectual, but I hope it makes sense. It's a past tense with continuing present implications. I am glorified in them. I have been glorified in them. And I am being glorified in them. And I will continue to be glorified in them. You see, the 11 apostles, the 11 disciples, are the key link between us and Jesus. They are the eyewitnesses. They are the ones whose testimony is very important. It is their experience and their testimony that will be key to the understanding of future generations of who Jesus is and why Jesus came. And they are the key link for us in, on the point of coming into a relationship with Jesus. We rely on their testimony. We rely on their experience. We rely on what has happened through their lives. We rely on the writings of Peter and Paul. Paul, of course, wasn't one of the 12, but came later. But they are a key link for us into coming into a relationship with Jesus. And Jesus' key point, therefore, is that he is glorified in these 11 apostles, and he goes on being glorified in him, in them, because they are the first group of people who have responded rightly to him. That's the point that he makes in the letter. I came to reveal God, in the prayer. I came to reveal God, and these apostles, these disciples who you gave me, have recognized who I am and on whose behalf I act and what I am doing, and they have responded rightly to that. So I hope I can make this point clear. How is God glorified? According to Jesus, he is glorified through this authentic apostolic response to him, with the implication that God will be glorified as people respond in the same way as his apostles responded. God isn't glorified through places and programs. it's very easy for us to fall into the trap of thinking that that's how God is glorified. That somehow God is glorified by us holding meetings or having outreach events or by having buildings or by having good art. He is glorified through a people. His people. Now again, I need to be clear. The prayer isn't teaching that God is glorified through any group of people, just so long as they claim to be God's people. He's not teaching that. Because in verses 6 to 9, he's talking specifically about the apostles, the 12 who followed him, God's first chosen disciples. And by describing them and their authentic response to Jesus from these three different angles, Jesus puts a very tight definition on what kind of people God is glorified through. Did you hear what he said? I have revealed to your glory to those you gave me out of the world. They were yours. You gave them to me. They have obeyed your word. So we can't say God is glorified through just anybody. He is glorified, according to Jesus, by those who give themselves, are given to Jesus, and who obey his words. He isn't glorified by anyone who just decides in a vague way, that they are going to worship their own God in their own way. And that's so much of the theology nowadays that we are seeing around us. Bookshops are full of books on spirituality. I meet so many people who say, I worship God in my own way. I follow my own practices. I do my own thing. It's very clear, isn't it? From John's Gospel, chapter 17, that Jesus is saying, I've been glorified through the apostles because they recognized who I am, why I have come, and they are following your word. That's the principle that identifies who are God's people. Who are the people that God is going to be glorified? Jesus says in verse 6, I have revealed your name to them. Now you know this. Names are very important in Jewish culture. Because names reveal something about the person. And if you go back into the Old Testament, you'll see that time and again, God is given names. God gives himself a name that reveals who he is. So at the burning bush, Moses says, who shall I say sent me? God says, tell them Jehovah has sent you. I am. It's the name of God. It reveals something of the character and the personality and the heart of the person. So we find as we read verses 6 to 9 that Jesus is saying he is glorified in the apostles that God has chosen and given to him. Those to whom Jesus has revealed specifically the character and the nature of God. And they have shown themselves to be God by receiving that revelation. They are his people because they obeyed, they accepted, they knew with certainty, and they believed. This isn't a promise that anyone who follows some vague notion of their own God and tries to be moral, that somehow they will be glorifying God. This is a very specific statement that the apostles who accepted Jesus as God, who recognized who he was, who was given to Jesus by God, and who obeyed his word, they are the ones who are his people. And they are the key link between Jesus and us today. There's nothing special about them as people. They're ordinary folk. They're fishermen. That's why I find it surprising that Jesus should turn his attention, when he's talking about the glory of God, he should turn his attention to his disciples. They're ordinary men. They're flawed. Read the gospel accounts. You'll find that they are completely flawed. They fail. They mess up. They get things wrong. But they are the ones who God has given to Jesus, who Jesus has revealed to what they could not work out for themselves before he came. But they have accepted, obeyed, and responded authentically to what God reveals to his people. So it's not the apostles of themselves who glorify God. It's their response to Jesus that brings glory to God. And just in case you're thinking it, I will say also, it's not apostolic descent either. There are some sectors of the church that will suggest that it is a physical line, a DNA line, if you like, from the apostles down through. It's not that at all. The disciples recognize Jesus' divine appointment, and that's how God is glorified, as they respond to God's revelation in Jesus. So here's the point that we really have to grasp this morning. God is glorified in his people who belong to him as they respond to him authentically. Now, isn't that encouraging? Small churches, run-down buildings with poor finances, small numbers of people can still be people, can still meet in places where God is glorified, because it is the response, the authentic response of authentic people that glorifies God. So this morning, as you come into this building with a heart that says, I know who Jesus is and I want to belong to Jesus, that's the heart that brings glory to God. And maybe in your daily life, maybe in your working life, you sometimes meet in the office with a small number of Christians. Maybe you're the only Christian. Or maybe you have a small Christian union, or you have there's only a handful of you here for a midweek meeting. Maybe sometimes you're even just alone in your room praising God. Remember this. God is glorified in his people as we respond in an authentic apostolic way, whether there are 10,000 or two. Jesus himself said it, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst. God will be glorified because you put me in the rightful place and you respond from a heart that wants to belong to me. God will be glorified. He will be glorified whether we are 10,000 or two. He will be glorified whether we meet in a cathedral or a cowshed. He will be glorified whether we sing with a massed choir or unaccompanied, because we have hearts that are committed to him. So here is an important question this morning. Are you a real Christian? Are you a real Christian? Do you have a heart that will result in glorification to God? Are you putting Jesus first in his rightful place at the center of your life? Are we recognizing this morning that without him, we have nothing? Without him, we have no relationship with God. Look at the piece of string. Without his blood, the sin cannot be taken away. That's the authentic heart that God is looking for this morning. So that brings us to our subheadings. Because God is glorified in his people, he is committed to protecting them from the world, setting them apart for the world, and sending them into the world. So we read in verse 11, Jesus says, I will remain in the world no longer, but they are still in the world, and I am coming to you. Holy Father, protect them by the power of your name, the name you gave me, so that they may be one as we are one. While I was with them, I protected them and kept them safe by that name you gave me. None has been lost except the one doomed to destruction. I'm coming to you now. I say these things, so I'm still in the world, so that they may have a full measure of joy. My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. You see, because God is glorified through his people, opposition to those people from Satan and the world is inevitable. This is a common theme through the New Testament. Jesus says people who are authentically mine, they will be opposed. They will be resisted. They will be persecuted. They will face all manner of difficulty in the world. Because they are glorifying God. And if there's one thing Satan hates more than anything else, it's that God be glorified. Satan's sole objective is to bring down God's authentic people. And because the world hated Jesus, so the world will hate his people. They will mock us. They will consider that we are fools. They will consider that we have lost the way. But notice, Jesus' prayer is not for immunity from persecution. It's a prayer that God's people and their witness will stand through persecution. That God will continue to be glorified through his people, even though there is opposition. And that's what verse 15 shows. My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. Jesus is going to the Father. He knows that glory will come through his authentic people and that they will face opposition, and he prays that they will have protection. And how will they be protected? Well, verse 12 tells us they will be protected by the power of your name. The character and nature of God that Jesus has revealed will protect the people. His authentic witness through his people will be protected. The message will be protected by the name of the Creator God. And the key word in verse 18 as we come to it is as. As you sent me into this world, I have sent them into the world. And here is the challenge to us. If God is glorified through the authentic response of his people, and he will protect that down through the ages, God will protect his people not as a roped off garden behind a shield, but he will set them apart by his word and his works in order to send them out into the world. That's what Jesus is saying will happen to the true, authentic believer. They will hold the key to glorification of God. So where do they need to be? They need to be out in the world just as Jesus was out in the world. Facing that persecution, standing up against that persecution, providing a witness to the glory of God. So here is the challenge. Our energy should be spent 100% out in the world with his word. We need to tear down the walls of the church and get out into the world and reveal the glory of God through his word. God is glorified in his authentic people, and we are set apart as the messengers, as the one who will reveal what God is like to the people, and we are sent out into the world to perform that work. That's the challenge to you and to me this morning. God will be glorified. God is glorified through his people. He has set us apart. It started with the apostles. He set them apart so that the message could be revealed to you and to me. And he has passed it down through the ages so that we today, in 21st century Southern Hampshire, can get out there and share the word with others around us. He is not willing that any should perish. And he will be and is being glorified through his people. So take comfort this morning. Take strength this morning from knowing that the true, authentic people of God are protected as they are sent out into the world. And we glorify him. God bless you, help you, and encourage you in Jesus.